one day it all really just comes to a head for me, and I'm on my way to work, I'm on the tube, and I get off the underground at Oxford Circus, where the agency is, and I just can't leave the platform. I'm asking all these questions in my mind of, like, what are we doing to ourselves when we're telling ourselves we're consumers all the time? What am I doing when I'm a propagator of those messages, when I'm just another of the priesthood? And I'm staring at the wall, I'm staring at the ads, and I'm watching a train go by, stop and go, and another one. And I'm starting to feel this like rising sickness in me.
Our approaching is to Stonebridge Park. Please stand back from the platform edge.
And then I'm like, I'm physically sick. I'm I'm sick on the platform. And at that point, I'm funnily enough, I know I can't really go to work that day, or probably ever again.
And that is the end of John Alexander's career in the advertising industry.
Stop! We're going round in circles!
Providing we believe...
Three, Mr. Shifter. Let refreshment. Oh.
Thank you most kindly, madam.
When a good cup of tea really counts.
I don't think you need worry about that, my dear.
Welcome to Living Planet. I'm Neil King, and in this episode, we're exploring the ripple effects of swapping a life of consumerism for one of citizening. Might be little used, but citizen is also a verb, with roots dating back to the late 1600s. And it's seeing a resurgence. But what does it mean, and how can it help us tackle the climate crisis?
The Parker Lady in white roll gold, £9.95.
For mash, get smash.
Small cigars from Benson and Hill.
Back in the early 2000s, when John graduates from university, he gets a job at a leading advertising agency in central London. He's keen to get started in this glittering industry, to claim his place in the working world, or at least what he thinks is his place. And he's excited to learn how to make his mark.
My first boss, when I first arrived in advertising, described my job to me, really. He said, what you've got to remember is that the average consumer sees something like 3,000 commercial messages a day. And he said, you've got to cut through that. You have to make yours the best.
More recent estimates suggest people are now exposed to anything between 4,000 and 10,000 daily ads, many of which are fed to us digitally. And that trend is set to continue. Industry analysis suggests that by the end of next year, the global advertising market will be spending 80% more than it was before the pandemic.
Stop! We're going round in circles!
But back to John. He's not too fazed at the prospect of finding ways to cut through the already deafening noise of companies and organisations trying to peddle their wares. He has previously tried his luck at becoming a professional athlete, so he feels he has what it takes to rise to this new challenge.
I was very happy in making mine the best. I have a competitive streak that's pretty strong. I guess the logic inside, it's a bit like, you know, that old thing about the person who stands up in the front row at the football stadium and then everyone has to stand up behind them. That's effectively what's going on in our brains and in the world around us with these consumer messages. So you compete by trying to find whatever way you can to make yours the message that gets there smartest, quickest, fastest.
Yeah, nice colour, isn't it?
Compact.
The mole is, if you want poetry, if you want
fight to the shell of it, fight to the shell of it.
But the novelty soon starts to wear off. And what it reveals for John is a whole lot of uncertainty about the industry he has signed up to be part of.
Over time, I just started to ask deeper and deeper questions about what we're doing in the world when we're effectively telling ourselves we're consumers 3,000 odd times a day.
With that question occupying his thoughts, he takes some time out and goes to live in Zambia, wondering if international development might suit him better. Ultimately, it doesn't. But his time away does make him want to do something that feels more constructive. So when he gets back to the UK, he turns his advertising hand to what might be seen as conscious consumption.
Train over plane, fair trade chocolate, these sorts of things. But actually, in that phase of my career was one of going, this is nowhere near commensurate with the scale of the challenge either. Like, all we're doing is selling something slightly better while 20 times as much money two doors down the road is being spent promoting the opposite.
But that is not all that is preoccupying him. Looking at the world around him, he is drawing correlations between the crisis of loneliness and the idea that people are independent and isolated. He is recognizing the relationship between inequality and competition as a way of solving problems. And he is seeing how ecological destruction is tied to the belief that humans are somehow impossibly separate from nature. And he acknowledges the role of advertising in everything.
I think the advertising industry is, as most industries are actually, deeply embedded in a logic that says actually the right thing to do is to pursue self-interest. The right thing to do is to provide the choices, to set out the array of glittering choices that people can choose from. Because if everyone pursues their own self-interest, that will add up to the collective interest. That is the underlying logic that pervades the advertising industry, but also pervades most of our society for the last 80 years or so. And actually, it's the cause of most of the challenges of our time.
For all that, he says it is a story with an internal logic, which most simply don't question.
And until such time as you challenge that story, you can be good within it. What I realised was that I wasn't just trying to be good within a story that I came not to believe in. I was actually a key propagator and spreader of that story. And once I ceased to believe in that, it became a deep threat to myself and my well-being, and I basically tipped into self-hatred, really.
Having finally turned away from the industry that was making him sick, John finds work with the UK Heritage and Nature Conservation Charity, the National Trust. It is operating along transactional lines that invites visitors to buy a ticket for the chance to roam old houses and grounds. But John sees an opportunity to try something new that actually involves the public in these places of shared national interest and inheritance.
It was the perfect place to start to explore these ideas that were building in me around what would it look like to use the same kind of skills, but not to sell people stuff or get them to click things, but to invite them into their agency as citizens, to invite them to contribute their ideas and energy and resources. I did an awful lot of work around children and nature. We created a marketing campaign, allegedly marketing campaign, that was called 50 Things to Do Before You're 11 and 3 Quarters, that was actually about rebuilding the connection between children and nature, and was a crowdsourced list. So we were asking people to contribute their ideas for the experiences they believed everyone should have before they were 12 years old. It's a very different way of thinking about these sorts of tasks.
He and a team of others also set up a project called My Farm. Using the line 10,000 farmers wanted, no experience necessary, they invite online voting to get people involved in making decisions around sustainable food production, as opposed to just buying what has already been grown.
So it became a very exciting and creative playground for the work that has since become all of what I do.
Other projects follow, and before he knows it, he's writing and publishing his book, Citizens: Why the Answer to Fixing Everything Is All of Us. It contains stories of collective citizen action to tackle problems relating to affordable housing, education for girls, access to healthcare, and the climate. He has no idea where it will go, or the nerve he is about to hit.
That set of ideas was just in my head, really, and in the sort of people I was directly speaking to. and it had begun to feel incredibly heavy. So in a way, the book, the writing of the book wasn't like, I'm going to write a book. It was like, get out of my head. And I think maybe that's like, that's why, like, these ideas have me rather than I've got these ideas, right? Like, I can't but try and like do what they demand of me.
The book maps out three different incarnations of collective human experience over the course of history. The first he calls the subject story, which dominated for centuries and was characterized by a handful of leaders essentially telling everyone else what to do, which, for the most part, they did. The second, the consumer story, only emerges after the First and Second World Wars, but builds massive momentum over a few short decades.
The story is an idea of how to be good in the world. I mean, Milton Friedman, you know, the famous Milton Friedman saying the social responsibility of business is to maximize its profits. Friedman wasn't saying business should maximize its profits to make as much just because making money is fun, right? He wasn't like, put money in your ears and stick your tongue out. He was saying the social responsibility of business is to maximize its profits. The right thing, the good thing for business to do is to maximize its profits. That is the consumer story as applied to organizations. And so for individuals, it's a story that says the right thing, the good thing, to be good, increase consumption, grow the economy.
But on a planet of finite resources, continued growth is having a detrimental effect. Around 40 countries have already used more resources than the planet can regenerate this year. And rampant production of consumer goods is responsible for a large chunk of the greenhouse gas emissions that lead to the soaring temperatures connected to drought, excessive heat, and other extreme weather events.
The highest possible aspiration in the consumer story in that logic is to be less damaging. Like, all we can be is the least damaging possible consumers. And that is not an aspiration. That's not something that gets us wanting to do something in the world.
Which leads to the third part of John's book. Called The Citizen Story, it shines a bright light on the potential, opportunity and enthusiasm for a different way forward. Outside the mold of a consumer, he showcases everyday people in different parts of the world who have achieved significant changes in their communities and beyond by working together in the name of a broader benefit.
Humans are a useful part of the ecosystem when we play our proper role, right? And that is what we start to open the door to when we conceive of ourselves as citizens, when we conceive of ourselves as finding collective agency to do generative, constructive stuff in the world, rather than just seeing ourselves as individuals and trying to minimize our negative impact. It's just a total flip.
The book seems to hit a chord with a lot of people. Initially, John has a page on his website which says, "Invite me and I will come." He goes to lots of places, but receives so many invitations that he eventually has to take the page down. Meanwhile, other people who don't yet have a project to talk to him about are quietly reading his book, taking it all in and allowing it to sow the seeds of thought about what might be.
I honestly don't remember what like prompted me to pick it up, but the book cracked something open and it gave form to feelings that I hadn't yet found like the words for. And it just like reminded me that there's another way to be in the world and that we don't have to live as consumers, but we can like live as citizens, as carers and co-creators. And also the people in the book are very normal, ordinary people. Like, there's nothing, you know, particularly like groundbreaking about any of them, apart from the fact that they're choosing to put their energy in different places than most people do.
Ellie Meredith is coming to the end of high school in the central English county of Shropshire when she reads John's book. Her upbringing has been steeped in nature. Surrounded by woodlands and countryside, she has spent lots of time in nature, walking her dogs or just lying on the grass listening to the wind.
I feel like nature was my playground and kind of my teacher in a lot of ways. I really struggled at school. And I was kind of just like desperate to be outside. And then after school, that's where I was most of the time, kind of sort of just relaxing, kind of tuning into that, you know, slower sort of pace of existence. And I just like being outside more than anything else.
It's that very love that Ellie has for the natural world that's making her anxious about what is happening to it.
Good evening. Tonight, Queensland is burning. I'm coming to you from just outside the township of Tara on the Western Downs, in the heart of a bushfire emergency.
She's around 10 years old when she first sees coverage of Australian bushfires on the news. And although she tries to suppress what the images have stirred in her, she can't shake a deep sense of worry. It has started to take root, and her growing understanding that Earth is experiencing a climate crisis starts affecting her in a way it doesn't seem to be touching those around her.
To be honest, I think I felt completely alone in it. Like, I kind of started to care about it on a frequency that just didn't match those around me, and that was pretty overwhelming because it's difficult to kind of find the people that you can talk to about it. And I was like riddled with guilt and kind of confusion and like just sadness, like what was going on in the world.
Let's turn now to three extreme climate events around the globe, which many believe are linked by man-made climate change: a record heat wave in Japan, major flooding in Australia, and a deadly avalanche in northern Italy.
And I kind of felt a little bit betrayed by the adults in my life, who just said like, oh, it'll be fine, like, don't worry about it, we'll fix it. But it, you know, it wasn't, and it still isn't. And it felt like the world was sort of falling apart and no one really wanted to name it. And like, I was kind of desperate and longing at that point to kind of be part of something bigger than myself. And I didn't want to sit on the sidelines anymore.
So she emails John. It's the week she leaves high school for good. She has no goal in mind when she reaches out, other than to thank him for the book and to tell him it has shifted something for her. She doesn't really expect him to respond, but he does.
And he replied on my very last day on campus, which felt really fitting. And I said, it'd be really nice to just like hang out on a phone call or something.
I was getting a fair bit of inbound communication once the book was out in the world, and there was a bit of momentum building. But I'm really awake to what it's like to be a young person in this moment in time, right? Like, and I'd done a couple of talks at universities and these sorts of things. But to actually get someone who was prepared to contact me and say this spoke to me at some level, I was like, okay, I just had an instinct that there was someone here who this was meaning something more to.
They end up meeting in London to talk about the ideas John has given voice to and the resonance Ellie is feeling. She explains that the stories in his book have cut through some of her feelings of being lost and given her a sense of hope.
I'm definitely infected by the citizen story, and John's kind of way of looking at the world just felt like really refreshing compared to what other narratives we were kind of being sold. I mean, you know, like certainly at school, like when you have like a careers advisor come in and they're like, well, what do you want to do when you like grow up? And I was like, well, I just want to kind of be outside and do things that feel good. And they're like, well, you know, we can't really help you with that. Okay, cool. Like, I was the only one in my school year not to apply for uni. So that was a pretty kind of uncomfortable time. But I, you know, it was a weird one. But I knew that I wanted to do something else. So I kind of actively chose at every corner to just do that instead.
For me, I don't feel like there's a future that I can shape right now. And I want to kind of put that love that I have for the planet into doing something like the people in your book.
During that first meeting, and there have been many since, Ellie describes her love of the natural world and how happy she feels when she's outside. She tells him she wants to be involved in something like the citizen action stories told in his book. But she doesn't know where to begin. As she is laying all of this out, John has an idea.
I really deeply believe that if we're going to break out of these stories, we're going to be led out of them by folk who haven't been so steeped in them that they can actually naturally live in something else. They can choose to inhabit a different logic. And so I was instrumentally using Ellie from the moment I heard from her. I had an instinct to sort of to pick up this connection and understand what she was up to. And then, well, as you can already tell, as your listeners can already tell, the energy of this human is pretty punchy. So just tried to support it all the way I could.
The first thing that, like, John said to me was, like, go and find the others. And I was like, okay, how do I go and find them?
Because Ellie's concerns were related to the climate, and because being in nature is what makes her happy, John suggests Ellie make contact with a group called the Reaction Collective. They are located in different countries across the world, including the UK. So Ellie starts volunteering with the collective online. Before long, she's invited out to the Alps, not only to see where it all began, but to feature in a short documentary about the inherent potential in taking a community approach to meeting the challenge of the climate crisis.
And ironically, that was on my birthday, so that was the best birthday present I'd received up to that point. It was the invitation to go out and do that. And then that kind of process started, the kind of actionism story.
Also first coined in the deep past, actionism is not a widely used or perhaps even widely known word. But up in the Alps, as she's introduced to different members of the ReAction Collective, it's what Ellie is witnessing.
So basically, here's going to be a bit of cutting. And here are some screen prints.
She meets and mucks in with the team fixing up and creatively rebranding old ski wear for resale at reasonable prices. This not only means more people can afford to dress warmly enough to get outdoors, but it also generates profits to put into environmental regeneration initiatives. And it keeps clothes out of landfill, which, as Ellie learns, is hugely relevant in a world where up to 85% of clothing ends up on rubbish heaps or being incinerated. According to the United Nations, the rate of clothing production has doubled over the past 15 years. And studies suggest the clothing sector is responsible for up to 8% of global greenhouse gas emissions. Equally, making the clothes that hang in our wardrobes requires enough water to fill more than 80 million Olympic-sized swimming pools. Ellie is also introduced to people who run a second-hand shop and others who collect food waste from a local town to turn into biofuel. She's taking it all in and feeling at ease.
When I was there, it kind of felt like that was the first time that I was really in it, like really in reaction. And I felt at that point I found the others.
So I'm heading to Antropia, which is a supermarket that turned into a community space.
She also visits an old supermarket that ReAction has creatively repurposed to benefit the community and the environment. Where there were once shelves of food, there is now second-hand furniture and clothing, as well as spaces for the community to gather and teach each other new skills.
I think at one point there was even like teaching people how to repair their own cars and stuff, all in this space that had been abandoned by consumerism in this perfect metaphor.
But perhaps most of all, it is a place that generates a sense of being a part of something bigger by working collectively to find creative ways to act.
Finding ReAction gave me permission to imagine another way, like to stop believing that my only role in life was to consume and comply. It just demonstrated that you can be in relationship with one another, with the land, with community, and that there's like that way of being is not only possible, but it's already alive in so many places.
The film that documents her journey from feeling overwhelmed and alone with her worries about the climate crisis to, as she puts it, finding her crew is aptly called Actionism, the art of finding your people and taking collective action.
This is where the power of the language is so powerful, because it's, and when you juxtapose it with, like, not to critique activism, not to say that we don't need activism, but activism is a sort of accepts where power is now and says, like, how do we try and change that or reject it or whatever? Whereas actionism is just going, what can we do? Like, what if we come together, what can we do that I couldn't do on my own? And what can we do right now, right here? It's not immediately enough, but it speaks so powerfully to the kind of the deep need for agency that we all have.
By the time Ellie returns to England, she has a better sense of what she wants and even needs to do to move forward. She starts an 18-month apprenticeship, which allows her to work with ReAction and simultaneously study corporate social responsibility at a university in the city of Manchester. She sees weaving the two together as a chance to spark meaningful change beyond the collective.
It's kind of demonstrating that there's something else that we can do now and kind of actively moving towards the future while still kind of being in the present.
The kind of leadership that Ellie's now showing as part of the ReAction Collective is potentially transformative. Like, these things start in these ways that they bubble and connect, but this is really a very powerful thing, I think.
reaction has massively felt like a homecoming and like a remembering of what actually matters now. It's just about showing up with kind of questions in both hands and your heart kind of wide open to, you know, the massive kind of complexity that is the Reaction Collective. And I just like feel completely like rerouted now, and there's that kind of like pulse of life and possibility that I can feel again and be really attuned to. And I no longer like think that I on my own kind of in my generation needs to kind of carry and shoulder that burden of the climate crisis.
She's now able to take a single step at a time, aware that each one of them is moving towards a bigger vision. Knowing she is no longer alone is a source of stability, but so is having found an approach that she felt was right from the start.
And the action that Reaction was taking at that point felt very different to the action that I was told to take at the time, which felt very joyless and like big sacrifices. But they were showing that it can be really joyful and colourful and creative. And I hadn't seen that before, to be honest. To me, that the kind of action activism was all very protests and placards, and you had to go and shout on the street for an afternoon. And that wasn't my vibe. I'm neurodivergent, and being in places of lots of protest and shouting was just not an environment I wanted to be in.
Ellie still feels that mainstream messaging on climate awareness and action is missing a vital opportunity to encourage the kind of involvement that can have an impact.
We're not guided in a way to do something different. I just got like, properly frustrated by it because, you know, I just felt riddled with guilt anytime I tried to do something else because it was never quite good enough, or I wasn't being activist enough, or there was just something about me that didn't really kind of hit the bill on what was the expectation to kind of how you should be showing up for the planet. And then the kind of the joyful things that you end up doing are so much better than the other stuff.
She still cares deeply about the state of the Earth, but knowing that neither she nor her generation can solve the climate crisis by themselves, the burden of feeling they should has eased. And she has also learned to see her own concern from a different, more galvanising perspective.
Climate anxiety, I don't think, ever really fully disappears, even when you're surrounded by people who understand in a way that I'd never kind of experienced before. I also kind of learned that that's okay and that it doesn't have to disappear for us to keep going. If anything, it can be used as like a force to keep us in motion. But I feel like you kind of do have to kind of have that awareness of okay, so there's stuff that I can do day to day, but actually the real work that he's doing is the finding of the others and the acting, and, you know, not the, okay, I'm going to get my disposable coffee cup out of the cupboard and go to a coffee shop because, you know, that's the thing that makes me feel good.
Both Ellie and John have travelled far on their respective journeys. Starting from different places, they have ended up on the same path, understanding and experiencing how making use of citizen agency genuinely can lead to change. And the key is working in community.
This is not an easy time to be human. And acknowledging that and feeling the pain of it and finding the others in order to be able to hold that together and to be able to act together just is the work in this time. And it's not easy, and there's no point pretending it is or pretending that we're all happy and joyful every minute of every day.
And also, we can't keep like clinging to certainty and expecting that we can keep like buying our way out of this problem. Like there's a lot of stuff that we can unlearn, and it's easier to do that when we're in community with others. Like a billion choices have led us here, and we've got to make a billion more to feel and act our way towards something better and more meaningful and joyful.
This episode of Living Planet was produced by Tamsin Walker and edited and mixed by me, Neil King. Our sound engineer was Jan Winkelmann. With thanks also to Two Step Productions and Reaction for the inclusion of some sound from their film Actionism. Living Planet is available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. What do you think of this episode? We'd love to hear your thoughts, so please do send us an email or voice message. Our email address is livingplanet@dw.com. Of course, you can also leave a rating or review on the podcast platform of your choice. Thanks for listening, and bye for now.
On this season of Threshold, we'll meet people who are devoting their lives to listening to what other beings are saying.
These animals have incredible social lives. We need a better understanding of how important sound is in their society.
It was a sound that I was completely unfamiliar with, and I could be confident that no human had ever heard that sound before.
Find Threshold wherever you listen to podcasts.